And let's go now to our series, Dollar for Dollar, where NPR's Uri Berliner has been trying to figure out what to do with money in a savings account that's been losing value to inflation. He's putting $5,000 from that account to the test. So far, he has invested in assets like stocks, purchased entirely on the basis of their future potential earnings. Today, Uri wades into the art world, where the rewards are not always financial.
If you go onto a site like ArtNet or Saatchi Online, you can shop for art by price, style, or even size. It's not that different from buying a mutual fund on the web. This suits Cappy Price just fine. She's a former Wall Street portfolio manager who now consults with clients about art as an alternative asset. She loves art for its beauty, but she also says it's an investable asset, one that wasn't really accessible to ordinary people until recently.
The internet is driving the ability of the masses to do their own research, do their own due diligence, just as they do with a stock, really enabling individuals to determine and place their own value on individual pieces of art.
Why invest in art? One reason, says Cappy Price, fine art has a proven track record as a good choice during hard times.
It outperforms in times of economic turmoil and trouble. It has outperformed during all of the wars of the 20th century. It's outperformed during the last 27 recessions.
Like any other asset, the market for art goes through ups and downs. Over the past 60 years, the total return on art has been very similar to the return on the S&P 500, says Mike Moses, a retired NYU Business School professor. He's the co-creator of the May Moses World All Art Index. The index tracks repeat auction sales of fine art.
If you use the last 30 years, the S&P substantially outperforms art. If you look at the most recent 8-10 years, art has outperformed the S&P.
For paintings in my price range, we're talking a few hundred dollars. There's no May Moses index, no record of auction sales to use as a guide. So I have no idea whether it's a smart move financially for me to buy art. But I do know this. Art is different than other investments. It's there in your house, part of your life.
You are telling people something about yourself when you hang it. I think that emotional investment gives you, a certain tie to that work that you don't find in other objects that you buy.
Now, the emotion part of the equation is fairly simple. As I look through hundreds of paintings online, I know for sure I won't buy a rendering of a clown or a panda eating an ice cream cone. The hard part is assessing value in what's so fundamentally a subjective purchase. So I ask Cappy Price, how can I tell if a painting selling for, say, $500 or $1,000 is worth it?
You look at the comparables, you see what their peers are selling their work for, work that is, similarly sized, and start from there.
Before too long, searching online, I find a painting I want. It's an abstract work called Flower Study 14, inspired by irises.
They're fresh. They're spring colors, yellow, blue, green, white.
That's the artist. His name is Vladimir Krylov, and I reach him in Vilnius, Lithuania, on his cell phone. A full-time painter, Krylov sells work from his studio and online. The way the web relentlessly categorizes art by price, style, and size, that doesn't bother him at all. He says it allows him to watch the competition and keeps him in shape. And he seems comfortable straddling two worlds, art as commerce and art as passion.
After all, most people buy art because we love it.
I purchased Flower Study 14 somewhat impulsively. I didn't bother with research. I just liked the way it looked. I pay $450 for the painting and $139 to have it shipped from Vilnius to Washington, D.C. Krylov appreciates my appreciation, but I say, what if I turn it around and flip it for a quick profit? What would you think?
It all depends on the price. The offer would be too good to refuse. Probably you would be right to accept it.
I check in with Cappy Price one last time after making my online purchase. Not a bad choice, she says, especially because it's painted in the style of the Impressionists. They're always popular, but
it's unlikely you'd be able to turn around and sell it tomorrow. This is an emerging artist. This is an artist who is not a brand name. Well, that, again, goes toward perhaps there being some difficulty in reselling the work.
Who knows? Maybe, as Vladimir Krylov says, I'll wind up getting an offer that's too good to refuse and bank a profit. But if not, I'll be happy to keep Flower Study 14 hanging on my wall. Uri Berliner, NPR News.
Our book reviewer, Alan Chews, has been turning the pages of a thriller. It borrows from Stephen King, a house with a wormhole that somehow allows for time travel. It recreates the monstrous chilliness of scenes between a serial killer and his victims, a la The Silence of the Lambs. It could easily have been a pretty derivative novel, but Alan Chew says The Shining Girls by Cape Town writer Lauren Bucus manages to turn such borrowing and theft into a success.
Bucus's book, set in Chicago and spanning that city's history from the early 1930s to the early 90s, stands as a marvelous narrative feat. And her heroine, the smart and spunky Kirby Mizrahi, is as thrilling to follow as any in recent genre fiction. Kirby first meets the time-traveling, Midwest, low-life serial killer Harper Curtis when she's about 5, and then about 15 years later, as he stalks her along the lakeshore while she's walking her dog. More about this ghastly encounter in a moment. And then, 4 years after that, as his nemesis in her long pursuit of this incredibly brutal and cunning murderer. Kirby is the only victim who survives her initial attack. When the killer's knife sinks so deep into the body of her dog, the animal attempts to defend her, that he can't pull it out in time to finish the murder, the plucky victim, holding her intestines in place, runs off to find help. After a long recovery, Kirby takes an internship in the sports department at the Chicago Sun-Times. There she makes a plan to catch her assailant, even as he moves back and forth in time and crime, eventually to discover that Kirby has survived. The killer feels a sharp edge of awareness, Bucus tells us, when he enters the magical house. There he discovers the names of his victims listed as if in a vision, and he sees that it's his goal to find the girls through different times and places. You will feel that same sharp edge of awareness as Lauren Bucus takes us on a frightening journey in time and punishment.
Alan Chews, reviewing Lauren Bucus's new thriller, The Shining Girls.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.
Netflix says the internet screaming of the streaming, I should say, of the children's programs it offers goes up in the summer by 30%. Maybe people are screaming as well. It's not hard to figure out why streaming of kids' programs would go up so much. School's out. Screens are on. This month, we're focusing on media for kids, and our critic Eric Deggans says Netflix, as well as its rival Prime Instant Video from Amazon, are both trying to capture a big and growing market.
There's a secret war brewing for the attention of children everywhere. And the soldiers in that conflict are the cutest characters you can imagine.
Thus, the Powerpuff Girls were born!
My name is Turbo.
SpongeBob SquarePants!
The stars of TV's most popular kids' shows are all over Netflix and Amazon.
Dora, come get me!
On Monday, Netflix announced it will get 300 hours of programming from DreamWorks Animation, the home of Madagascar, Shrek, and Kung Fu Panda. It's an important move for Netflix because last month, rival Amazon picked up episodes of Nickelodeon shows such as Dora the Explorer and SpongeBob SquarePants.
Order up!
Turns out, TV series aimed at children are an important part of each online service's success strategy. And they're not just buying up old kids' shows. They're planning to make their own. That's why, when Amazon developed a batch of original shows, it selected just 2 adult comedies and 3 kids' shows.
In a creative galaxy.
Creative Galaxy is a series from the producer of Nickelodeon's Blue's Clues.
Pom-poms make me feel excited and light me up. And when we're lit up by something, we put it in our
idea box.
It's for preschoolers who love art projects, but it's also a chance for Amazon to build loyalty with kids and create characters they will love for years to come. Now, I've been watching my 8-year-old daughter navigate kids' shows on Netflix, and now I understand why kids and family shows fill 20% of all the hours their customers stream online. Netflix has put some thought into this. Their kids' area features a strip with pictures of characters, so my girl can click on images to pick a show. On a desktop, laptop, or tablet computer, the area's background is a light blue, so I can see from across the room where she's surfing. The upshot? Kids can control their own viewing, but in a controlled space. And because small children like to watch the same thing over and over, they can do it on a laptop or tablet or someplace where they're not holding the family TV hostage. Parents out there, you know what I mean. This week, Netflix also rolled out an online guide for parents. I'd love to get periodic emails on what my kids are watching, and Amazon could make it a little easier for kids to navigate on their own. Still, my young one now draws zero distinction between calling up a SpongeBob episode online or switching to Cartoon Network on cable, which offers an important lesson. The same way young people taught us graybeards to use social media, crowding onto Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr before we had any clue what those names meant, today's kids might teach us to erase all of TV's technological boundaries, with a little help from a talking sponge and a wisecracking alien.
He doesn't really have a gray beard. Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. The pace of a basketball game keeps commentator Frank DeFord engaged. He wishes some other sports would learn.
In Milwaukee, cartoon characters dressed up like various sausages race at each Brewers game. In Washington, five of our beloved presidents do their own bratwurst ramble. But the character I want to appear at every baseball game, and at a couple of other sports too, is the crocodile from Peter Pan, who swallowed a clock and shadows a terrified Captain Hook. Somebody has to scare athletes into playing faster. In baseball, golf, and tennis in particular, we are being slowly lulled to sleep before every pitch, every shot. The pretentious preparation is interminable. In baseball, the pitcher holds the ball, pondering what to throw, as if his decision, two-seamer or breaking ball, would determine the fate of humankind. In tennis, after every point, the server towels off more than a movie Cleopatra alighting from her bath, then carefully selects a ball, bounces a ball, again and again and again. And in fact, it rather resembles a clock. Thank the Lord baseballs don't bounce, or pitchers would do that as well. The irony is, too, that by delaying, the pitcher is surely helping the batter more than himself. The great Warren Spahn is attributed with saying, "Hitting is timing. Pitching is upsetting timing." So Spahn got the ball back and promptly pitched it, and thereby won 363 games because the batter didn't have all that time to get comfortable. In golf, protracted discussions with the caddy about the wind velocity and the choice of club rival, I am sure, the nightly extended pillow talk between Bill and Hillary. It is estimated that 4 million golfers have given up playing in recent years because the game just takes too long. Cue the crocodile. Incredibly, too, these sports all actually have time limits in their rules. It's just that they're almost never enforced. The timid officials humor procrastination and celebrate boredom by giving these spoiled athletes too much time to make simple decisions. It is also demonstrable that in the two popular sports where there is a well-publicized time limit that is scrupulously honored, that's basketball and football, the need for the teams to produce a shot or a play in the allotted time adds to the drama as the seconds count down. He got it off in time! Clocks not only reduce the duration of whole games, but they create regular little climaxes. Get me that crocodile with the clock. Sick 'em, boy. Sick 'em.
It took Frank DeFord 2 minutes and 56 seconds to say that. He joins us each Wednesday on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Greene.